Welcome to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. Que voy a hacer, je ne sais pas. Que voy a hacer, je ne sais plus. Que voy a hacer, je suis perdu. Today on your show, developing a better relationship with money and how to teach and learn innovation. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at careercycles.com. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Morgana Ray is an author, professional speaker, coach, and expert on helping people develop a better relationship with money. Morgana is author of Financial Alchemy, 12 Months of Magic and Manifestation, and is contributing author of Heart of a Woman in the Workplace. We'll speak to Morgana Ray in the second half of today's show, but first, Stephen Armstrong has shifted career gears and is ready to reprise his first Career Buzz experience from 2008. We'll hear his story of career change from management consulting to education and training. Stephen started his career as an aerospace engineer and began as a shop floor apprentice. Later, he entered management consulting, first with KPMG and later with his own company, AMGI. As a consultant, Stephen's led 23 large-scale turnaround and strategic change assignments. He's worked in aerospace and defense, electronics, newspaper, media, and more. Stephen is also Chief Innovation Officer at Samco Machinery. Stephen began teaching in 2009 at the University of Toronto's Faculty of Applied Science and Engineering. He teaches the management and application of innovation and the history and philosophy of energy of engineering. We'll also be joined in a bit by Mark Morreale. After graduation from George Brown College in Mechanical Engineering Technology, Mark Morreale worked as a mechanical designer, and while working, he continued his education at U of T, where he earned a mechanical engineering degree. Mark currently works as a mechanical designer at Athena Automation, a company founded by Robert Shad, and is also studying with Stephen Armstrong in the Master of Engineering program at U of T. Stephen Armstrong, welcome back to Career Buzz.
Welcome, or thanks. Thank you very much, Mark. I'm looking forward to this.
So it's good to have you back here. It's been a couple of years, and you've been through a few changes here, and I know you're doing some interesting things in your career now. What are you liking about what's going on in your career?
Well, I would call it, you hear in the financial world, the concept of the balanced portfolio. So I would say I have a much better balanced portfolio as far as my career is concerned. I'm involved in many, many fields, not just the area of management consulting, which is what I was, when my core pedigree was up until a few years ago. So now I teach 4 master's courses at U of T in the Faculty of Applied Science and Engineering. They're called elite courses. E stands for entrepreneurship, L for leadership, I for innovation, T for technology and engineering. And I'm also publishing another book for Cambridge University Press. And I also do some corporate seminars. But 75% of my time is with the one company, it's Samco Machinery, and I've been helping them since 1999, first as a consultant. And then I got fed up with the going from company to company in 2009 as part of this massive change I made in my career life. I just formed a retainer relationship as chief innovation officer. And so basically it's building and scaling the business. And we've gone from about a $9 million business in 99 to 50 million with exports around the world. And it's, you know, high speed machinery in the metals industry. And it's not really about the product, it's about the people.
Yes.
People.
You're doing a lot of things. You're teaching, you're doing seminars, you're writing, and you're working as this chief innovation officer. What skills would you say you draw on regularly to be successful in this balanced portfolio career?
Many. Well, and like as I told you, I was in great turmoil in about 2007, and I had, in many ways, the previous interview we had in 2008 or 9 expressed that I was totally disillusioned. I had worked in the U.S. defense industry at Lockheed Martin. I'd been at British Aerospace. I'd seen a lot of things with, you know, how the world works, you know, with respect to the world economy and war, etc. And I became very, very disillusioned, and I couldn't figure out what way to turn. And most focus in those days, well, even nowadays, is money, money, money. And it wasn't enough for me. So I went back to the University of Toronto and got a master's in history and philosophy of science and technology. And there's no question that that change absolutely transformed my thinking. And that led me in all these new directions. I met the vice dean of engineering at U of T, and he knew I had a book, and he looked at the book and he said, "Hey, would you like to teach an innovation course?" I said, "Yeah." So I taught the course. It was in January, first kicked off in January 2010. There were 35 students, and I'd never taught in my life other than in industry. And the whole the experience was wonderful, and it was a big success. And 3 years later, I've now, 3.5 years later, I've put 300 students through my courses, and also run 40 project master's project teams with some of them with industry as well at the University of Toronto. So it's been it was serendipity. I was looking for something, I didn't know what it was, and it came to me.
So let's deconstruct that serendipity. You know, there was something going on, as you were saying, you were in crisis in 2008, 2009. What was it that led you back to take this master's degree at U of T?
Well, again, I became extremely disillusioned by colleagues, by friends, by the I really worked at the very top of industry. I mean, I worked at the CEO level in all these companies, at least vice president in the major aerospace and defense, and then in other companies, the newspaper and all, I was exposed right at the CEO level, coaching the executive teams. And I just became disillusioned. I won't get into precise reasons. Let me just make it clear that having all the power and being at the top and focused entirely on making money is a very empty life.
Yes.
And for me, it was empty. It lost all its meaning.
So what's the connection then between that sense of disillusionment and going back to school and taking a master's degree?
Exactly. Well, at the time, you could say I was trying to escape life. I was trying to escape the, quote, the real world. So I went from the real world into the ivory tower. And if you do history and philosophy at University of Toronto at Victoria College, you know, it is extreme ivory tower. I mean, the professors, no, most of them are totally career professors. Few have ever worked outside the academic environment, you know, since they were teenagers. And so most of them are in their, you know, 50s, 60s. Some older, and so it was, but I loved them, and I loved the whole, it was a different world. I remember one day in a philosophy class looking at the towers across the University of Toronto's campus, and looking at the financial towers and saying, and knowing what goes on inside those, like knowing the culture, the social culture, the political culture of the banking industry or the aerospace industry, and realizing just how completely different academia is and how academics are. We were sitting around in a room with a fireplace, and everybody was talking about Socrates, it was about realism and anti-realism. Don't ask me what it means now, but that's what the conversation was. And it was just amazing for me to be involved at that. And I felt like I was about 22 years old again.
So it re-energized you in a way. It going back to school gave you a different perspective and a new energy?
Absolutely. It was beyond fantastic. Yeah. And by the way, my money collapsed. In other words, if I was making 10, I went down to about making $1. In other words, if my regular income was $10, I went to 1. But I'd money saved up, so I wasn't doing foolish things. But it collapsed for a whole year, basically.
So this kind of transformation, you didn't know what you were aiming for. You went back to school as a kind of, I don't know, an escape, a step away from.
Definitely.
More than a step toward.
That's right.
And then the clarity, some kind of clarity emerged. And as you say, serendipity, which often plays a role once you start moving in a direction that feels better. But something clicked for you that said that teaching and learning and helping others learn at the University of Toronto would be a good move for you.
Well, what happened was, you see, history and philosophy, the actual subject, history and philosophy of science and technology, is completely and absolutely theoretical, academic. There's absolutely no practical there's no practical application other than in your how you think as a person. And what it does, if you think of engineers and scientists as left-brain thinkers and philosophers and artists as right-brain thinkers, if you can combine the two, you actually start to think in completely different ways. So it went in the business world, basically it's run by MBA engineer types. And those, I'm talking about the let's say the manufacturing business world, manufacturing industry, and even the finance industry. It's run by black and white thinkers, and it's run by people that are they're not thinking out of the box, and they actually are intolerant of artistic type, humanitarian type people or humanists. They don't think the same. The two different worlds.
Isn't that changing, though? Isn't that you see in
with young people
schools, with young people and the business schools now really focusing on social enterprises, yeah, and a different focus now coming out of business schools.
I see that. I'm still not a fan of business schools. I never have been. I may eventually even teach in one, but I've never been a fan. I blame actually a lot of the big problems on the MBA schools. I've said that in my previous session with you, that if you walk into the Rotman School and what you see on the wall is all the endowments from the big banks, etc., and you walked in Victoria College and it's rickety old rooms, they've no money, but it's a true seat of intellectual thinking. I don't believe the business schools truly teach the deeper level thought and truly teach self-reflection. And I believe these modules of sustainability and social enterprise, etc., I think they're all good and well done, but it will never compare with a true academic and deep analysis in philosophy, history, or art.
And now, as you say, you've shifted, or you've expanded, let's say, from left brain thinking to a combination,
a combination.
We're talking to Stephen Armstrong here about teaching history innovation. He is the chief innovation officer at Samco Machinery. He's also an instructor at the University of Toronto. Here on Career Buzz, I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CIUT.FM worldwide. So, Stephen, you've been teaching innovation. You've been teaching a few courses, but in particular, I'm curious about innovation. I have one of your students on the line. He's going to join us in a moment. I'd just like to get your first statement on whether innovation can be taught.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'd like to hear a quick perspective on that from you, and then I'm going to bring Mark Morreale and one of your students in. We're going to have a bit of an open conversation. So how can innovation be taught?
Okay, well, first of all, I have to put it in context. So for 22 years, but prior to my consulting experience, I was a professional engineer, so I was designing products and processes, etc. But once I got into management consulting, then it was all about change management, and so it was about engineering change. So it was about designing a future vision and then implementing it through executives, through teams, etc. So I know for a fact that there is a science of innovation. There is a science of designing what the future will look like and then plotting it and planning it and then engineering it, whether it's transforming a large company or transforming your own life. I know that's a fact. When I studied the history and philosophy, I remember saying to one of the professors, because history and philosophy of science and technology is, you could also say, it's the history and philosophy of innovation, from ideation right through to application and changing society. So I said to one of them, do you know, there's a science to this. And he absolutely said, absolutely no way, because social historians, etc., will study history in the past and will interpret it all in many, many different ways. And they'll all argue, they'll spend their lives arguing about how Newton came up with his theories and his philosophies. But I know for a fact that with respect to innovation, it no question it can be taught from the ideation through the creative phase, and especially because innovation and creativity is nothing without implementation, and the two together create innovation. So I packaged all my work over the past 25 years into a whole series of lectures and modules, and typical semesters 12 weeks, but the course would span 14 weeks. But I didn't just teach the theory. Then I set up a second course called Applying Innovation, and that's where we have external industry partners. And I might add, I've formed a relationship with George Brown College because they have lots of industry partners. So I run about on the applied course, which kicks off next week, this for the third time. There's about five external industry partners, and we put a team of U of T engineering students with them to help transform or improve how their business runs. And so there's proof that, that innovation can be taught. There is a science. It is repetitive. It can be scaled, and it can build enterprises. Absolutely no question.
All right, let's bring Mark Morreale in. Mark is currently working as a mechanical designer at Athena Automation, a company founded by Robert Shad of Husky Injection Molding. And he's also studying, Stephen, with you in the Master of Engineering program at U of T. Mark, welcome to Career Buzz.
Hello, Mark. Hello, Stephen.
Hey. How you doing, Mark?
Good,
so,
good.
Mark, first of all, what do you like about what you're doing in your career these days?
Well, you know, I'm working in my chosen profession, most of all, and that's very important to me. I'm doing what I love, and that's design. I've always loved, as a child, I used to take machines apart, take toys apart, and learn how they worked and put them back together. So now I have the opportunity to design these things from scratch. And so it's really kind of something I feel like I've been born to do, and I feel blessed that I have the opportunity to do it now.
Right on. And Mark, you're just kind of coming in quietly, so if you could just speak up
bit, sure.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
You went to school. You went back to school twice now. You originally did a engineering technology program, and then you went and got an engineering degree after that. How did the degree make a difference in your career?
Well, before I started the degree, I was working as a draftsman, using 3D CAD software to design complex products. I knew there was a lot more to the products that I was designing. I knew that there was a lot of engineering behind them, and I was still young. I was thirsty for knowledge, and so I decided that it was the right time in my life to continue my education and pursue the engineering degree. Now, during the degree and after the degree, I felt that the experience I had gained as a college student was very important, because I had gained some practical knowledge, and in the university I was learning the theory behind the practice.
Yes.
And that really helped to sort of gel the knowledge that I was gaining and
yes.
really make it relevant to my education.
Yes, I bet you that made the engineering degree education that much more relevant and different. You were probably quite different than many of the other students who came in straight from high school.
Yes, than many of them. That said, I do have friends who went to college with me, and they went right through U of T with me as well. So within any engineering program, I'd bet that there was a few people in my position, and that they have a lot to offer their classmates.
Yes. Now, you've subsequently come back to the University of Toronto to do this Master of Engineering program. What led you to make that choice?
A few factors. Some of it was disillusionment with a previous job. I wasn't happy doing what I was doing, even though I was working as a designer. I think it has a lot to do with some of the things Stephen had mentioned before. I was working for a former professor, and it just didn't work in terms of how the business was being run, so I felt that I needed to do something else. And so I decided to pursue the MEng degree, because I've always looked at myself as a lifelong learner, and so it was a great opportunity to not only build my credentials, but learn more about my field.
Right on. So in the degree program now, the Master of Engineering, among other things, you are studying innovation. And you're working in a company started by an innovator, Robert Shad from Husky Injection Molding fame. First of all, what does innovation actually mean to you?
Well, innovation to me is looking at an existing problem, and there's got to be a problem. It can't be you can't just innovate for the sake of innovating. And you're looking at it with a fresh perspective, and you're proposing something better than what exists, and something that actually works. I find that sometimes people are just trying to be different for the sake of being different, and they call that, they'll slap innovation on that as a label. But to me, true innovation is something that has to be different and better, and it has to work at the same time. And in order to do that, you have to have a pretty thorough understanding of the market that you're trying to serve and the business function that you're trying to perform.
Can you give an example to listeners of some innovation that you've been working on, maybe at Athena or anywhere else, just to give us an example of different and better and that works?
Well, with Athena, there's not a whole lot that I can talk about. We're a very new company, and we're getting to market. But, you know, if you can look at the history of my employer, Robert Shad, you'll know that he spent a very long time with Husky Injection Molding Systems designing a very successful business. And what we've been doing here is really just looking at better ways of doing things and having an opportunity to start from sort of a clean sheet of paper and look at it from a fresh perspective. And I think that's the most important. may be a solution in the marketplace already. It may work. But starting from a clean sheet of paper and being able to start from scratch really provides the right atmosphere for really innovative solutions and to do something which is truly better.
Right on. We're talking to Mark Morreale and Stephen Armstrong here on Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM, worldwide on CIUT.FM. So we're talking about innovation here, and Stephen, you're teaching one of the courses, Mark, that you're in, and we were just talking about whether innovation can be taught, and Stephen makes a case for, yes, it's a scientific discipline, in fact. Mark, how is it on your end to be learning innovation in a kind of classroom and I guess, real-life environment?
To me, to learn innovation is to learn how to listen. A lot of times, people, especially in the engineering industry, they want to throw their ideas out and they want to, you know, demonstrate how smart they are. But really, there's often a lack of listening, and that to me is what stifles innovation. A good engineer or anybody really needs to be able to listen to their customers, listen to their coworkers, listen to the person on the shop floor who is telling them something that is likely relevant information and it's part of the overall system that brings their product to market. And by listening to various participants in this process, you're able to get that sort of systems level understanding or that 30,000 foot view, use an analogy, and propose something which is truly different that takes all these different factors into account. So listening, I think, is the key thing to learning innovation.
So there's a listening and understanding of the need, and then there's this synthesizing all of that and being creative to come up with some sort of answer response to the problem.
Right, and I think that's something that's more of a challenge to learn. You can't learn synthesis. You can experience it, and
yes,
you can try it, and you can make mistakes, and you try it again and again and again, and eventually you'll realize that as you're synthesizing ideas, you develop the ability to quickly judge them and evaluate whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, or combining different ideas into an even better idea, and that's what goes on a day-to-day basis here at Athena.
So what kinds of learning experiences, Stephen, you're creating these learning experiences, both the classroom and then applied.
Yeah, I can
what kind of learning experiences foster the development, yeah, the learning of this innovation that we're talking about?
It's a great question. It's strange we didn't script this, but it's a great question. The number one method of learning is self-directed learning, experiential learning, and discovery-based learning, and learning by doing. People don't learn by just listening. They have to listen, but the person, the teachers, professors must become enablers and coaches and facilitators for learning, not the sage on the stage. The sage on the stage where the guy's lecturing all day long is a complete waste of time when it comes to transferring knowledge. True knowledge is grasped when the student is allowed to actually apply it and to practice it. And one of the things that I tried to do in the course was, one of the things I learned in the philosophy and history course was in Cambridge and Oxford, the old days, they used to say, you read for a degree. So one of the things I implemented in these courses was making students read. I give lectures, but now what I've done, I've videotaped all the lectures, and the lectures are on the Blackboard learning system. So I make the students watch that in their own time, and then I use the class time for team-based work. And I use the class time for students to make presentations, etc. Mark's actually enrolled in the Applied Innovation course. He took the Management of Innovation a couple of years ago, and the Applied course kicks off for the third time next week. And so a lot of that work is going to be work in the classroom, where students are presenting as a team, and they're solving problems together, and they're doing discussions, and then each of the teams themselves, there's lots of breakout sessions. So I believe true learning and knowledge is when the students themselves are engaged in the discovery of the knowledge, and they're not having it shoved down their throat.
Mark, your perspective on that, like the actual practice, the team-based practice of coming up with creative solutions to problems, what was your experience with that?
It's very valuable, especially in the MEng program, because you have people coming from diverse backgrounds. As an undergraduate student, I was learning with just mechanical engineering students, but in Stephen's courses, you have the opportunity to work with people who are not only from other engineering disciplines, but but they're from other schools. They've had completely different experiences, and when you all come together to work on a project, it broadens everyone's horizons in the group, and it allows you to see these fresh perspectives, and it does foster that innovation because everybody is bringing a different perspective to the problem.
So one of the keys really is not just the individual who learns innovation, but the team that comes together and the diversity of the team that comes together to create solutions to problems.
Absolutely.
What if one person becomes the innovation spark? What if, you know, Mark, you go back to work and you become this innovation spark because you've taken this great course with Stephen, and you're all about now innovation and becoming a spark for that. But what if there's not enough other people there to fan that spark into a flame?
Well, to use your analogy, you know, a flame needs three things, right? It needs fuel, oxygen, as well as a spark. So, you know, the way you can look at it is the fuel might be the resources in the company, and the oxygen would be sort of the culture within the company. So if you take any of those two things away, the spark will just be that, a spark. It'll be an idea, and it'll be gone before you know it. So there has to be several things in place within the team. There has to be the resources in order to be able to innovate, that is, you know, having the tools that you need. But also sort of that the it has to be in what everybody in the team breathes as well. They have to have that innovation, and it has to be part of the culture, and they have to understand that new ideas have to be cradled, and they have to be sort of nurtured for a little while, and eventually they'll take a life of their own. So it's a matter of having a team that is all on board with that mentality, that it's not so much the individual, it's about the output of the team.
Right on. So that's a really great analogy. I mean, the fuel is the resources that the company provides, the oxygen is the culture, and the spark is the individual. I bet you that works great sometimes, and I bet you it doesn't work great in other times.
Right.
Stephen, what's your experience with that?
Well, as in the, again, at the U of T program called Elite, E-L-I-T-E, L stands for leadership, and leadership can be trained, and it is having the right leadership that sustains the innovation. So in the course, and one element of the course that I teach is leadership. Another element is culture, et cetera, as well as processes. And of course, just understanding the various disruptive changes that innovation brings, you know, the science of innovation. But the number one measurement of success for an enterprise or a team or a soccer team, a football team, is the leadership, the coach, the person that's actually driving it. So it doesn't, the leader does not have to be the one with the spark, the initial idea. The leader is the one that actually enables the others and inspires them to work on an idea, and inspires the sparks to originate in all kinds of places, and then fosters the coherent culture to take that idea and move it forward. So leadership is absolutely at the heart of sustaining innovation. And when you hear stories like Ford invented the production line for the, you know, the Ford Motor Company,
yes,
it's all nonsense. And this is what the History and Philosophy course taught me. It taught me that the way we're taught history is a lot of nonsense. There is no such thing as these heroes. Even Einstein didn't sit in his room on his own and suddenly come up with a theory of relativity. There was all kinds of teamwork, all kinds of tensions among people, and ideation and sharing ideas and community and conversations that we're having now that were occurring for these individuals to package the knowledge and to bring it to fruition. It's a simplistic schoolboy historians that write, oh, who somebody said like Neil Armstrong discovered the moon. Like, it's such nonsense. Or Neil Armstrong, my namesake, was the space exploration guy, the first guy. Well, of course it's nonsense. There were thousands of engineers and scientists behind the Apollo program, and to actually attribute it to one person, the hero, is a lot of nonsense. So leadership of teams is what matters.
That's a great point. We live in a culture of celebrity, and we all want to just oversimplify things
total
and
nonsense.
Say it was Neil Armstrong who invented the moon, and it was Henry Ford who invented the production line, and et cetera. So, great point. We're just going to have to take a break now. You're listening to Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, speaking with Stephen Armstrong and Mark Morreale. We're going to continue this conversation for a few more minutes after break. Stay tuned, and we'll have Morgana Ray join us for the latter part of the show.
This hour of Career Buzz is brought to you by...
I'm a dental hygienist and a proud professional. I chose dental hygiene because I like health sciences and working closely with people. I received a quality education from a variety of dental professionals in a beautiful facility. I'm happy I chose Regency Dental Hygiene Academy. Visit regencydha.ca for more information.
Join us for the Alzheimer's Society of Toronto's 2013 Manulife Walk for Memories, a wonderful indoor musical walk on Saturday, January 26. Go to alzheimertoronto.org to become a walker and invite friends and family to join you to help raise money to support all those living with Alzheimer's. We'll have great entertainment, refreshments, and prizes. So register now at alzheimertoronto.org or call 416-322-6560 for a brochure.
From the Roots Up, CIUT 89.5 FM, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
We're back at Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. I'm practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at careercycles.com. Before continuing on with today's show, I want to let listeners know about the amazing archive of Career Buzz inspiring career stories. So if you go to careercycles.com, there's a Career Buzz button right there on the website on the right-hand side. Lots of great archives. On January 2nd, we did a series starting on hidden gem careers, hidden gems. Carrie Iron spoke about her career as an epidemiologist. Find out what are the three things she loves about this hidden gem career and how you can find your own hidden gem. So that's on the Career Buzz link or button at careercycles.com. We're back talking with Stephen Armstrong and Mark Morreale about, especially about innovation and innovation in the workplace. We've got a few more minutes to continue on with this. Mark, you were talking to us a little bit about what it was like to learn innovation, and we've heard that innovation is actually a discipline that can be taught. What's your experience, or what can you share with listeners about how to spark innovation in your own workplace?
I think it's a matter of being a little bit courageous and not being afraid to make mistakes. A lot of times people have ideas in the workplace and they don't want to speak up. They're afraid that, you know, like you were mentioning, a lot of it's about the celebrity culture, and they don't want to be the one who's being ridiculed. They want to be everybody wants to be the superstar in the workplace. And so a lot of people are often afraid that by putting some new and different idea out in the open, that it might be put down, it might be shot down. There's often a lot of politics involved in that too. So I think the key thing is to sort of just, when you have an idea, just jump. Don't be afraid to make the mistake and put it out there. Occasionally, people will make mistakes, and occasionally, ideas will get shot down. But the key is to learn from that, and next time around, don't be discouraged.
Yes.
Do it again. And the key is repetition, because I don't think it's, or it may be possible to be a natural innovator, but I know that I'm certainly not one. I know that it's something where I've had to try again and again, and more often than not, my ideas are shot down. But when a true innovative or good idea does come forward, you have to be prepared. You have to be willing to put it out there and put yourself on the line for it.
Yes. It almost speaks to that culture that you were talking about, the oxygen that fuels the flame. And the culture needs to be accepting of possible failure. How can you put an idea out there if every idea has to succeed wildly? It's just impossible.
Absolutely.
Stephen, what's your perspective? What can listeners do to spark innovation in their own workplaces?
Well, first of all, innovation isn't just ideas. The idea, if you were to measure it and you were to say on a scale of 100, the idea represents like 3-4% of the action. It's taking the idea or the vision and implementing it and then sustaining it. And so all of that comes down, as I mentioned before, leadership. Having the right leadership, having the right culture in place where people are rewarded for their actions and rewarded for their efforts and successes and for their failures. And putting in the right business processes, the right management systems, making learning, like continuous learning, a cultural habit for everyone. Rewarding people and keeping open minds. But there's a lot, it's much, much more than the R&D
yes.
lab. Innovation is not R&D, and that's the first thing and Mark will probably remember it. The very first thing I do with the students the very first day is cut out the nonsense that research and development is innovation, and the government throws billions at it, and that's not innovation. That's only a small piece of the action. Innovation is any idea that adds value to society, to an enterprise. It can be a social enterprise, it can be a for-profit enterprise, but getting it, implementing it, and seeing value at the end to society is what innovation is. And if you were a militarist, and you, the Joint Strike Fighter program I worked on, that those aircraft are killing people. Now, those for the militarists are innovations. I mean, you see it on these documentaries where the guy's sitting in Arizona blowing people up in Afghanistan. That in itself is innovation. But then the next thing we have to ask, is it something that society really should value? Is it a valuable innovation? Man has been innovating since the first tool, which was the flint, where they chipped away. That was the very... humans are by nature innovators. Every single human we have by nature, from being living in caves, and we innovate through the use of tools, the tools of radio, the tools of cars, aircraft. You could say engineering is the heart of innovation, but it's not just an idea. It's society is a manifestation of the whole practice of innovation. Look all around us. These buildings and roads and bridges and aircraft and medicine, it's all the result of innovation. But, and again, it's about the application and the use of ideas and bringing them to market.
Right on. We're going to have to wrap up this segment. It's been fascinating. Let me just ask you each, to close out, bringing it back to your own personal stories. Mark, starting with you, what can you share briefly with listeners about what you've personally learned about making good career and life choices?
It's something my father-in-law once shared with me. He said, the only thing that you can't buy is time. And that's when you're making a choice in your career, make sure that you're happy with what you're doing, and that and that the time that you spend is time well spent. If you're killing yourself, if you're working very long hours and you're unhappy with yourself and what you're doing, the money is meaningless at that point. So I'd rather take a job with less pay that I enjoy rather than you know, a high-paying job that makes me miserable.
Right on. Great advice, Mark. Thanks. And Stephen Armstrong, personally, especially through this transition that we've talked about at the beginning of the interview, what can you share with listeners about what you've personally learned about making good career and life choices?
Well, I have to be honest. I think that the heart of the matter is the people that you work with. At the end of the day, you have to enjoy the people and the culture that you work with. And you have to know that when you actually leave work at the end of the day, your day might end at 11 o'clock, you have to feel as energized as when you came in. If you're going home or you're ending work exhausted, upset, sore stomachs, feeling sick, going home to your spouse and explaining to her how miserable you are, there's problems, you've got a real serious problem. You should be leaving home as inspired as when you came in the morning. That's a good measure. And your energy level should be as great at the end of your work day as it was at the beginning.
Great advice. Stephen Armstrong, Mark Morreale, thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz today.
Thank you very much, Mark. Mark Morreale, I'll see you on Monday.
See you at school.
Okay. Looking forward to it.
Guys, thanks so much.
All right. All the best.
You're listening to Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CIUT.FM worldwide. We're going to switch gears now and talk to Morgana Ray. She's an author, professional speaker, coach, and expert on helping people develop a better relationship with money. Morgana's program for attracting wealth has been featured in Entrepreneur Magazine, Wall Street Journal Online, PBS, NPR, among many others. Morgana's career includes 20 years in the entertainment industry, followed by training and work in coaching, in NLP, in hypnosis. Morgana is author of Financial Alchemy, 12 Months of Magic and Manifestation. Morgana Ray joins me live by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome to the show, Morgana.
Hi.
So welcome. Glad to have you here. What do you like about your career these days?
Well, I love what I do. I'm sort of a compulsive people helper anyway, and I found this socially acceptable way to be nosy and give people advice and be appreciated and well paid for it. So the quality of my relationships with the people that I work with, since I choose who I work with, it's just really, really so deeply rewarding. And I also have the ability to change things, which works really, really well for me. If I start to feel burnt out or bored with the one-on-one coaching, I schedule a retreat in Bali.
In Bali. Now, that sounds like a pretty nice alternative to the one-on-one. So you're an author, you're a coach, you're a public speaker. What are all the different things that you're doing in your career these days?
Well, underneath it all is really the same thing, which is simply trying to find the best ways to help other people. And what I found years ago was that I was burning out from making everything about a time investment. And I started last year looking at, well, how could I help the most people possible without killing myself in the process? I had to let go of this really delightful egotistical notion that the only way people could get help was if I'm in the room or I'm there with them. And so what I've been doing is finding ways to communicate and give people tools so that they can coach themselves and get their results without paying me $40,000. And that has been so incredibly liberating. I've designed my whole business model so that I could take off some months this year and travel the world with my sweetheart. That has been behind a lot of my business decisions, is how do I give value but also free myself up to have a life? And the happy benefit of that is that in 2012, I got more success stories than ever before, and I coach directly fewer people. So I really am moving into this whole model of helping people more with products than just time. Does that make sense?
Right on. And I want to find out more about that in the book, but I'd just like to grab a bit of your career story and how you got here, because you said it wasn't always this way. I said in the intro you had spent some time in the entertainment industry. What were the things that happened earlier in your career before you started this newer work?
Well, I've always had this, and I think I mentioned it for a moment, that I've always had this natural compulsion to help people, and I've always been really, really deeply fascinated by the human condition. So in college, I majored in religion because I have these questions of what is it to be human, what is this universe we live in, and how do we have a better experience? And then after college, I became an actress, which actually kind of looks at a lot of those same questions about what is it to be human, and the human experience. And while I was doing that and struggling, like so many actors do, I discovered coaching, and it helped me, and then I started coaching people in the entertainment industry as a hobby. And it was like I had a magic touch where within weeks of my first outing as a volunteer unpaid coach, one of my clients won an Emmy Award. One of my early actor clients got a hit TV series, a housewife from Maryland with no credits. I helped her get staffed up as a writer on another TV series. And I was so much happier when I wasn't focusing on myself and my own career. I was so happy when I was helping other people. And I made a very selfish decision that I wanted to be happy. And the irony is, the last year that I was acting, I was working all the time, and I was miserable. And I decided that it's easier to be happy helping other people, and that's why I became a coach 12 years ago.
It's so interesting to hear you say that it was a, you made a selfish decision to be happy. I don't know if you heard the very end of our last interview. Our guest, Stephen Armstrong, was talking about this really important thing to notice. If you're not leaving work at the end of the day as energized as you were when you started, then something's wrong, and you really should be feeling good about your work. And yet it's odd that we do say that it's a selfish decision to be happy. Why do you call it a selfish decision?
I say that without any guilt. It was just really practical. I made the decision for myself.
And it can be done. Like, people do that. I think the key thing for so many people who aren't happy is to make that decision also. And then the question is what to do about that. And I guess the clues from your own experience and this experience you had coaching started to show you the way. It was sort of like clues, like a breadcrumb trail that led you to what your next step would be. Did it feel that way, or did it feel like a much more of a big transition?
It was so easy. And here's the ridiculous thing, is I had no idea how heavy being an actress was. The lying about my age, the being nice to people who were not nice, and all of that nonsense. I had no idea how heavy it was, because it had become my normal until I quit. And the first thing I did was tell everybody my real age. And I took a month-long trip to Europe and then came back and jumped into coaching classes. And then a new problem arose, which was I already had a reputation for being really good as a coach. Even when I was doing it for free, I was getting all these results I was telling you about. People wanted to hire me. And I discovered that I was completely blocked making money. Even though I had my fancy coaching certification and I had an Ivy League education behind that, and I was good at what I was doing and I was getting results, there was something that would happen that would get in the way of me getting paid. My own guilt about taking money, worry about harming people, and even deeper issues that I had no conscious notion of it. And so I would take classes on building business. And I built the website and the brochure and the business cards, and I was great at marketing and all that kind of stuff, and nothing was working. So I would work with coaches on my inner game, great, great coaches. Nothing worked. It was terrifying, because nobody could figure out why I couldn't get paid. At the worst of it, I was struggling to hold on to one half of a bad client for $100 a month. And that's actually where my process came from, was when I failed so spectacularly at everybody else's stuff. And I still have the world's most beautiful vision board, and I had a millionaire mindset, and I knew how to overcome sales objections, and then they would still not show up. It was crazy. I had to find out what was going on behind the scenes in myself. And for me, it was my relationship with money, and I could only really get to it and change it when I imagined money was a real person. And when I had my change, four people hired me the next day at double what I'd ever charged before, and it just kept coming and coming and coming. And then I started trying it out on my clients and failing spectacularly at that, because I didn't understand what happened. And so I got to practice on all, because I had all these clients, and find out really what were the elements that needed to be present so that I could change their relationship with money so that they could have the results too.
So let's find out a bit more about that, because that's your book. Also, you've got a book called Financial Alchemy. And we are talking here to Morgana Ray, who's an author, professional speaker, coach, and an expert on helping people develop a better relationship with money. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CIUT.FM worldwide. So, Morgana, the Financial Alchemy book lays out some of these ideas, but it's especially about changing your relationship with money. And just a moment ago, you said something about looking at money as if it's a person, having a relationship with it. What do you mean by that?
Well, a lot of great teachers talk about relationship with money, but they're talking about abstract concepts like money as energy. Money is a tool. Money is an exchange of value. And Deepak Chopra says the divine field of abundance. I don't know how to have a relationship with the divine field of abundance, and I certainly don't know why I would protect myself from a divine field of abundance. When we are pushing money away or protecting money away, and how do you know you are? If you aren't making as much money as you want, if you aren't getting paid what you're worth, if you make it and you get rid of it and you lose it in mysterious ways, you are protecting yourself from money. And I say that because I have coached thousands of people over the last 10 years, and I've really noticed some very clear patterns. And so I didn't know any of this about myself until I asked myself the question, if money were a person, who would my money be? And I saw this big, scary, dirty, violent biker. I didn't know that that was my money.
So that was your relationship with money, was the big, scary, dirty biker.
So I felt, oh my, I imagined if I were at a live event with this biker, I would have my eye on him the whole time to create maximum distance between the two of us. And it was like a light went on. For the first time in my life, I understood that was what I was doing with money. People were trying to hire me, and I would subconsciously push them away because the money was not safe to me because of things that happened in childhood. So I broke it down into six really clear steps to get from A to B, A being scarcity, B being abundance. And I've also really taken 10 years and thousands of coaching sessions and give you the benefit of what I've learned that you couldn't possibly already know and put it into the book so that people can do this themselves.
So what are those steps? Now you've got everybody curious. The steps from A to B, the steps from scarcity to abundance. What are those steps?
I'm happy to share the steps. First is uncovering the root cause of why you're protecting yourself from money. And the big secret here is that it's never really about money. It can be easier to do this process if you've had some really bad experiences with money or if you're in real financial anxiety right now. But the real issues, the real root cause always has to do with what money represents, which is your worth, your lovability, and your safety. In fact, your right to exist. Those issues are really the root cause. So go for the pain. The pain is more important than the story. Your story doesn't even have to be about money. But step one creates the pain that allows us to get to step two, which is personifying the cause as your money monster.
Now, is it always a money monster? Do people generally have this kind of monster that you've described, or could it look, you know, some other way?
Well, I strongly, strongly encourage that your monster look human. It should not be a cloud or a big rock or a fiery pit or mist or a ghost. It's very hard to get rid of those, and they aren't real, and they're not as terrifying. So
all right.
The more personal you can make the relationship, the more real it is, the more seamless, effortless, and effective this process will be.
All right, so step two, personify. What do we do next?
Then you get rid of the bastard by whatever means necessary. And get rid of all the bloody bits. You want it gone, 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 gone. I broke up with the biker, but with my clients, they take out lightsabers and machetes and machine guns and crossbows. And one of my clients ran over her monster with a monster truck, which I thought was awesome.
All right, so the monster is dead. What do we do next? Number four.
When it's gone, you have this great empty space, and then you get the complete opposite. You can have a relationship, a new relationship with money as a person, and the most important thing is it has to be a person that you want in your life and so much that you want this person even though it's money, not because it's money. And it's not a fairy, and it's not Oprah or Gandhi or your higher self. You want for this to work. You really want your what I call your money honey. The best archetype is a lover. So, guys, if you like women, your new money is that woman who makes you want to be the greatest guy in the world. You know, she is gorgeous, and you just want to be her hero. And women, your new money is that guy who makes you weak in the knees, who loves you and wants to woo you.
All right, so it's a real attraction there. You're setting something up for a real strong attraction to happen. So once you've got that envisioned, what next?
Well, there are two more steps. Step five is you talk to your money and ask questions. Every question is designed to empower you. For example, money, what do you need from me so you can stay with me? By then you should know in your heart that this money loves you more than anybody in the world and wants desperately to be with you, and you have the power to make that decision. So step five is you talk to your money, honey. And step six is action. When your money, honey, tells you, I want you to do this, you do it. And that's that when the weird stuff happens. Like Katie Curtin, her money wanted her to play more. That was what he needed to be with her. She needed to lighten up and play. So she committed to going skating, and it was December in Canada and really, really cold. And she put it off, and she put it off. And on the third day, she finally went skating, came home, got a call, and received $10,000 without asking for it.
That's a pretty remarkable story. We don't have time to deconstruct that one. But we just have a couple of minutes left. If listeners are intrigued and they think that this is a really interesting approach, what's a very next step that listeners can take?
Well, I have lots of free stuff for the listeners. If you go to my website, MorganaRae.com, and my last name, Ray, RAE.com, I am having a 3-day telesummit next week on how to manifest money, love, and magic with great world thought leaders like Christopher Howard and Bob Doyle and Cynthia Kersey. And we're going to be really going deep on these topics. Nothing is scripted or planned. And I'm launching my book on Amazon on January 23, and at MorganaRae.com, you can see all of the dozens of top teachers who are going to be donating gifts if you buy the book on Amazon on January 23.
So that's the book, Financial Alchemy.
12 months of magic and manifestation. It's a self-coaching system so that you don't have to actually hire me.
Right on. Now, we've just got a moment left. Let me come back to the personal, Morgana, and wrap up with this question about what you personally have learned from the twists and turns in your story and your relationship to money and through acting to coaching. What can you share with listeners about what you've personally learned about making good career and life choices?
Every choice has to come from a place of self-value, self-worth, and self-love. And yet to tell somebody you should love yourself, I think is true, not helpful. Because if you said that to me, that would just go on my list of failures. Oh, my God, I don't even love myself well enough. So what I would want for you, and what I do, is I trick people into loving themselves by seeing, so that you can see yourself through the eyes of your beloved. And that's where the money, honey, has been so useful for me. Is I set my fees not based on what I think I'm worth, but out of my desire to